Good morning, Nexus. Welcome to our online service this morning. I am here at the Old German Woolen Mill, and this place is great because what I want to talk about is Celtic spirituality. And I don't know, I thought this had a bit of a Celtic feel with it, the old rocks and the ruins. So I thought this would be a good place to talk about Celtic spirituality. And the history of this building is interesting. If you look it up, ooh, some dicey things have happened here. In fact, the Hamilton Paranormal Society says that this place is highly active with paranormal activity, whatever that means. But so far, so good here. What I want to talk about, again, is Celtic spirituality. And most of us sort of know, of course, about Celtic stuff through probably mainly the St. Patrick guy. And of course, March 17th every year, the world collectively performs an act of cultural appropriation by celebrating St. Patrick's Day, by getting ham sandwich drunk and throwing street parties and dyeing otherwise good beer green. But for whatever reason, the world likes to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Everyone on that day likes to pretend they got a little Irish in them, I suppose. So we celebrate the Irish. Why, I'm not quite sure, but it's a collective day of celebration. But beyond the St. Patrick's Day, this St. Patrick guy was a real human. And he didn't leave us a lot of his words, but he did leave us a brief autobiographical sort of confession and, of course, a number of prayers that we know about today. And I want to use St. Patrick to sort of help us jump into Celtic spirituality. And it's interesting, his story, because he starts his autobiographical confession this way. My name is Patrick. I am a sinner, a simple country person, and the least of all believers. I'm looked down upon by many. My father was Calpurnius. He was a deacon. His father was Potitus, a priest who lived at Benevim Taberni. His home was near there, and that is where I was taken prisoner. And this is the beginning of Patrick's interesting story. At the age of 16, he is captured by Irish pirates from his home in Britain, and he's taken over to Ireland as a slave. And it's not just him. According to his confession, there were around 1,000 other people taken as slaves to Ireland. And in Ireland, he was forced to do the work of a shepherd. His master made him do shepherd work. And he toiled away there doing shepherding work for 6 years until he was finally able to manage to escape and makes his way back to his home in Britain. But something about Ireland just got in his blood. It was like he found the place magical and he couldn't stop thinking about the land and the people there. And eventually, St. Patrick goes on to become a cleric and he decides to head back to Ireland as a missionary. He wanted to bring the Christian path back to this land of enchantment in Ireland. And during this point in history, Ireland, Wales, and Scotland are actually quite unique. The linguistic similarities between these three areas point back to common Celtic ancestors. And for these Celtic areas of the world, there was a certain enchantment about it, their way of life with druid priests and stone circles and sort of nature spirits. It was a world of allure. And during this time, these three areas were also interesting because the whole world at that point was under Roman rule. But Rome was unable to sort of access these three areas. I mean, in the far north, at this point, Rome was unable to take on sort of the Scottish tribes in the north. In fact, Hadrian, the Emperor Hadrian, built a wall, kind of sealing off the northern tribes of Scotland. In the far west, Wales was also not under Roman influence. And of course, Rome never actually successfully conquered Ireland. And so they were sort of set apart from the way the rest of the world was operating at the time. While everyone else was sort of falling under Roman influence, these little pocket areas had managed to sort of maintain their way of life. The rest of the world was under Roman influence, and so the Christianity that spread over much of the Western world was sort of steeped and marinated in Roman culture and influence. And so when Patrick took the Christian path to Ireland and these Celtic sort of people, it sort of started a different brand, a different version of Christianity that was much more indigenous. And I love this about Christianity. It often sort of syncretizes with the different ways and different indigenous spiritualities over time. And so the version of Christianity we get in these Celtic pockets is sort of very different. It's got a different flavor, you could say, than the rest of the world that was under Roman influence. And for about 500 years, this Celtic Christian path sort of flourished until eventually the Vikings came over and sort of continually plundered Ireland. And eventually the Irish monks, they sort of gave up and abandoned their posts. But for 500 years, we had this unique flavor of Christianity. And it still is with us today. Now, there's a lot of rubbish that goes along with Celtic spirituality. A lot of people like to brand everything Celtic, but we still have these old sermons and prayers and sort of ideas from Celtic Christianity that I think are really helpful and can help us as we consider and close out this series, right? We've been talking about bumping into God more. And I think there's some aspects of Celtic Christianity that can help us with that, allow us to strengthen our eyes and understand and see more moments where God is active and working in our lives. I'm no Celtic Christian authority, of course, but there's two sort of things about Celtic Christianity that have stuck with me over the years. So I want to just share just two of those with you this morning. First, Celtic Christianity has a strong affinity, you could say, for the material. It's a very earthy sort of spirituality. And that manifests itself in a love for land and the pleasures of life. And you know, I've always sort of considered certain places around the world magical and sort of enchanted. And Ireland has always been one of those places. You know, I've gone to the US Southwest a number of times. I believe that place is pretty enchanted as well. And one of the reasons I've been able to go there is because Kristen has no interest in desert landscapes, but both Chris and I have wanted to go to Ireland and Scotland in particular. Both of our lineages sort of go back to those two countries, and we've always wanted to visit there. And woe to me, I just realized, Kristen just told me that for my 40th birthday, she was going to whisk me away to Ireland and Scotland for a week. But of course, COVID, you scoundrel and thief. I was unable to go for my 40th celebration. But while I haven't been there, the pictures, the ideas that I've seen of this place, it just seems like a magical land. And Patrick sort of felt the same way. There was something enchanted there, and that manifested itself in the way people saw the world, the way they saw land. When Patrick arrived back in Ireland, what he realized quickly is that the people there were very earthy people, and they celebrated their way of life and did their rituals around glades and buttes and rivers and mountains. For them, the earth, the land, was incredibly sacred. And we get the idea of thin places actually from them. The Celtic people would erect stone monuments all over the place. And gratefully, Celtic Christianity held on to that idea that land in certain places can be, well, gateways to heaven, as Jacob sort of discovers, right, in Genesis. Certain places are gateways to heaven. But for the Celtic people, this was all over the place. They erected monuments everywhere. And when Celtic Christianity came into the picture, they would erect stone crosses as well. For them, places, local places, were often gateways to heaven. Land itself could be a place where we encounter and bump into God. Within Celtic Christianity, almost any piece of land can become a gateway to heaven. Almost any piece of land can be a sort of thin space, a place where heaven and earth are sort of paper thin away. They're right next to each other. And in Celtic Christianity, what they would do with these pieces of land is they would erect monuments, stones, or erect crosses at places that they felt like they were spiritual, places they had bumped into God. And you see this all over the sort of Celtic lands, Ireland, Scotland, a lot of erected monuments in places that felt special, holy. And you know, it's interesting because today I still think we have this sense within us, even if we don't exactly call it that. You know, a few weeks ago, I was shooting out at Tiffany Falls, and I had gone there the weekend before with my kids, and I was fascinated because there's this river that sort of snakes its way up to the falls, and it's very shallow. And all along the riverbed, a bunch of people had erected little inukshuks, and some of them were, you know, only yay high, some were much bigger, but people had taken the time to erect stones in front of this waterfall and this riverbed looking up to the waterfall. And it's that sort of same instinct that's within us. When we come to beautiful places, special places, we have this sort of impulse to commemorate it, you could say, by erecting a shrine almost. And so I feel like that sensibility is still with us today. But what is really of interest to me about the Celts is it was always so local. You didn't have to travel far to find these special places, these pieces of land. For them, they dotted the landscape. It wasn't that you had to travel far to find a place. There was almost a holy well in every town. There was monuments and shrines all over the place. You didn't have to look far or travel far in order to see and encounter landscapes where we bump into God. One of the big advantages to me about COVID-19, if there is any, but one of the things that I've been grateful for is how I've rediscovered the beauty just around us. You know, driving around locally, visiting some places even for shooting, it has reminded me that beauty can be found anywhere, and there are magical landscapes not far from any of us if we just put in a little work, a little effort to see. And the Celts understood this. Land was sacred, and it didn't take much to have an encounter with God through landscapes. It just required eyes to see it. You know, I made a big mistake recently. My kids have wanted this game Zelda for Nintendo Switch for a while, and I held off. I was hoping to get to this Christmas before I got it for them, but they had finished some chores and done some things I had asked them to do, so I got it, you know, about a month ago for them, and that was a big mistake for me because the kids, they enjoy it, but they sometimes have trouble playing. They ask for my help, so I'm helping them in the game, and suddenly I'm addicted, right? Like, I'm all in on this game, and it's taking up way too much of my time. In fact, two Sundays ago, it was 10 o'clock, everyone is in bed. I was like, I'm just going to play a little Zelda before I go to bed. And so I'm playing. I looked down at my watch. It was like time had disappeared. It was 4:30 in the morning. Oh, my goodness. I scolded myself. I was like a bad dog. I'm like, bad, Brad, bad, bad, bad. I ran to bed. I can't believe I stayed up that late, but it sort of sucked me in. And one of the interesting things to me about this game is how there's little treasures and little magical portals and shrines all over the place. You just have to explore. You just have to have the eyes to see and go looking for them. And I think this is the idea with Celtic spirituality, with land and the way we bump into God. It just requires a little work, a little exploring, eyes to see. And when we do, what we realize is that there are gateways to heaven everywhere, places where we encounter God through nature in the physical, all around us. And so we still have this impulse, but like me, I think some of us have sinned and grown old. Our eyes have gone dull, you could say, to seeing the magic and beauty around us. But what Celtic spirituality understands is that if we have the eyes to see, if we're open to it, land can be a powerful place where we bump into God. Beyond just land, though, when you read through Celtic prayers, what you realize very quickly is that they're a very sensual people. It's a sensual spirituality. God is encountered in all of the good things of life. I mean, when Paul says in Acts 14:7, God has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. The Celts took this seriously. They understood all of life, all the good things of life, to be a gift from God. Or when James says in James chapter 1, do not be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. The Celts, again, they took this seriously. Every good gift is a moment, an encounter, a bump in with God. Or when Paul says again in Philippians 4:8, finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. The Celts took him seriously. And whatever was good about life was received by them as a gift, as an encounter with God. The material, the raw earthiness of our world, it's sort of, for them, all of these moments were encounters with God, and they reveled in it. And don't get me wrong, Celtic Christianity isn't a feel-good all the time sort of spirituality. These people knew how to both feast and fast. They often had ascetic practices along with them, but they certainly, when good things happen in life, food, nature, earthy stuff, when all of these things came to them, they received it as an encounter with God. I think what you walk away from Celtic Christianity with is a realization that for them, for Celtic Christianity, it is a life-affirming, material-affirming, earth-affirming, body-affirming, pleasure-affirming spirituality. Celtic Christianity, more than I think any other tradition within Christianity that I know, is a very body, earth, fleshy, affirming spirituality. We encounter and bump into God through our senses, through our bodies, through the material of this world. I remember Kristen has a story. She went to, for university, she went to Catholic school. I forget what it was called. Anyway, she had a nun as a professor, and in this one class she was taking, this nun talked about sex as sacramental, right? The goodness of sex is to be received as an encounter with God. It's a sort of mystical union, and so we experience sex not just as physical pleasure, but as a divine encounter. And the only reason I'm really telling this story is in hopes that Kristen's watching this and will be reminded of that. It's her story, not mine. But that idea of receiving the good, pleasurable things of life as a gift. I mean, this is why we celebrate the festival at Nexus, right? We had to skip it this year because of COVID, but for the past few years, at the end of the year, we celebrate as a community, right? And we get together and we play games over a number of days. We drink wine, we eat food together, we enjoy each other's company. And this is not just some, hey, let's blow off some steam and throw our hair down a little bit at the end of the year. I actually consider it a spiritual discipline we need to celebrate as communities. We need to enjoy the good things of life. And Celtic spirituality reminds us it's not just indulging. It's a discipline. It's an act of reminding ourselves that the good things in life are encounters with God, and we should receive them as such. Second, given Celtic Christianity's affinity for the material and physical, it's no accident or surprise that Celtic Christianity takes particular delight in community and friendship. Celtic Christianity understands that we frequently encounter God through flesh and blood, through the raw material of this world. And that means that we encounter and bump into God through other people, most particularly our friends. In fact, there's a specific concept within Celtic Christianity that I absolutely love. It's the idea of a soul friend. They call this anam cara. Everyone needs an anam cara, a soul friend. And what this means is, of course, we all have friends, but there are some friendships that are deeper than that, that go beyond that. And that's what they would consider a soul friend, someone in our life who is wise and compassionate. Those are the two ingredients of a soul friend, wisdom and compassion. And this was so important to their understanding and concept of spirituality and ways that we encounter God that St. Bridget actually once said this: anyone without a soul friend is like a body without a head. We need our friends, but not just any friends. We need soul friends, people who can speak wisdom and compassion into our life. And when we have those in our lives, Celtic Christianity says these are moments and places that we bump into God. Through these people, the flesh and blood of soul friends, we encounter God regularly. A soul friend is someone who's beyond a companion or someone we share mutual interests with. It's beyond someone that we simply talk about everyday things with. And you know, today more than ever, I feel like we need that. And I don't know about you, but I feel like sort of friendships today can often get stuck in certain kinds of talk. I mean, there's of course small talk about the weather and whatnot, but then there's also the conversations we have today that sort of still in my mind remain on the surface. And it, a lot of times it can be, we talk with our friends about politics, or let's talk and discuss this controversial issue. What do you believe about that issue? Or let's listen to this podcast and discuss those ideas, or let's read a book together and discuss the ideas in them. But there's something that's still sort of surfacey about that when we're discussing issues and never getting to what I'd call soul matters. I mean, consider a headline I just read in CBC just this week. The headline read this: pandemic pressure cooker is making couples seek out divorce and separation. And when you read through the article, it went on to say that family lawyers are encountering many more calls about seeking out divorce and separation. Our marriages under the pressure cooker of COVID are experiencing some trouble. And what is interesting to me is that a lot of times with friendship, you can talk about the most serious things in the world and never ever get to a question like, hey, how's your marriage doing? And so we can sort of fool ourselves thinking we're moving beyond small talk by talking politics or serious issues, and yet never get to the soul, you could say. Never get beyond sort of issues and into the personal. And a soul friend refuses to do that. A soul friend is someone who will ask the right questions and push us farther. And of course, it doesn't have to be intense all the time, but a soul friend is someone who won't just stay on the surface. A soul friend is someone who we can go to matters of the heart and soul with. And as Celtic spirituality teaches us, we need these people in our lives. And in particular for them, a soul friend was marked by compassion and wisdom. And I think it's worth digging underneath that a little bit. What does that exactly mean? Well, I think I would say this about friends with wisdom. I think they're people who can ask the right questions. They're people who ask better questions. You know, I remember one time I was complaining to Melissa Bowman that when I picked up my kids from school, I would ask them, you know, hey, how was your day at school? And I never really got a good answer. It was always like, oh, fine, it went well. And I was telling Melissa Bowman this, and I'll never forget what she said to me. She said, well, why don't you ask better questions? Yeah, why don't I ask better questions? So many of our questions can sort of, they don't really lead anywhere. I think a wise friend, though, knows the right question to ask, and when they know how to ask better questions of us. To be a soul friend is to learn to ask better questions. I mean, one of the things I'm amazed by in the Gospels is how often Jesus responds to people with a question. They come to him with an issue, or they want him to speak to something, and he replies back with a question. And I think this is incredibly telling. I think some of the wisest people among us, our wisest friends, are those who know how to ask good questions, better questions, questions that probe and get to the heart and soul. You know, it was interesting. Dave Thompson sent me an article by James K.A. Smith recently that speaks to this, and I found it absolutely fascinating because what he was saying in the article is that so much of our discourse today is about politics. It's always about politics. It's like we've reduced each other to just political machines. Where are you on the political scale? And in this article, he went on to talk about how we can do better than that. This is what James K.A. Smith says. I am entirely skeptical that our incessant public opining has done anything to deepen our capacity for the hard, good work of forging life in common. Au contraire. Indeed, I am convinced that our best hope for better politics is to resist a creeping totalitarianism about politics. To let the political override every other aspect of being human. Pretending we are always and only political animals is its own form of reductionism. In such a flattened world of politics, attending to other facets of being human is its own act of resistance. Oh, I absolutely love that. What he's going on to say is we need to learn to ask better questions of each other, not just, hey, what do you think about this political thing? We need to realize that we're so much bigger than our political views, our social views. And when we learn to ask better questions, we can probe that. We can explore that. He goes on to give some examples of what better questions might be like. And these are just starters, but stuff like this. What is catching your attention these days? I mean, what have you been looking at? What art or visuals are catching your attention? Or what are you listening to? Like, what music is moving you and why? What are you reading? What are you learning or growing to love that's surprising you? What are you making or creating right now? A soul friend is wise enough to know to ask better questions, to not reduce us as humans to simply political machines or people who are defined by ideas around social issues. A soul friend is wise, and part of wisdom is knowing how to ask good questions. A soul friend, of course, is wise, but a soul friend is also compassionate. And I think the compassion end of things is incredibly important as well. How we relate to people when we do get to soul issues is incredibly important because when people reveal intimate parts about themselves, it requires a finesse, a touch that understands that life is delicate and fragile and difficult. A soul friend is someone who exhibits, I think, a fierce compassion. And I think a lot of people would call something like this being not judgmental. And the whole judgmental thing is interesting. I think a lot of us are carrying baggage about judgment we've received in churches or other contexts. And I want to kind of get underneath that. It's like, what is that about? How do you not be judgmental? Does that mean you can't believe in right or wrong? And to me, it's not that. I firmly believe in right or wrong, that there are certain things and behaviors people do that are not good. They're poor choices. They're wrong. But I don't think judgmental has to do with whether or not we think someone's actions or behavior are wrong. I think being judgmental is more this. Being judgmental is that feeling or sense you get, expressed or not, that the wrong behavior or action you identify in others is something you would never do. To me, being judgmental is to look at someone's behaviors or actions and think to ourselves, there is no circumstance, no chance that I would perform or behave that way. But I think a great first question to ask ourselves when we see someone or notice something in somebody that feels wrong or offensive to us, I think a great first question to ask ourselves is this: under what circumstances would it take for me to do the same thing? And I think when we ask ourselves that question, what we realize is that we are capable of almost anything, given the right or wrong, I suppose, circumstances and context. All of us are capable of doing things we might see as wrong or poor behavior. So the question we ask ourselves, I think, in trying to be compassionate with others is, under what circumstances would it take for me to behave that way as well? And when we ask that question, I think we start to realize all of us are capable of doing things that we consider wrong or poor choices. I remember years ago, a friend of mine came to me with some issues. They wanted to reveal something to me, get something off their chest. And this person went to another church, and the first thing they revealed to me is they were too scared to reveal this to their own pastor. They were too scared of judgment. And so they wanted to reveal this to me. And what my friend revealed to me is that their partner had caught them sexting, I guess you could say, sending inappropriate text messages with somebody else, and it got quite intimate, and they've been caught, and so now their partner's unhappy, and they're feeling guilt and shame, and it's just this big, big mess. And you know, one of the first questions I think we need to ask ourselves when people reveal sort of certain heaviness, a certain weightness of the soul, a situation like this is, before I move to judgment, under what circumstances might I end up doing something like that? And I think the reality is, when you think about that long enough, there are circumstances. And of course, in life, you try to avoid and put yourself in circumstances that will lead to this. But when you start thinking through that, you realize, you know what? There are circumstances or situations if I found myself in that I could see myself doing the same thing. And to me, that's the heart of compassion, realizing that whatever we see in others is not so far from us. It's a sort of, but by the grace of God go I, right? And that's the heart of compassion. And a soul friend is someone who exhibits compassion to us. Soul friend can ask good questions, better questions. They're a person of wisdom, but they're also a person of compassion. And what Celtic Christianity teaches us is that when you find a soul friend, someone who exhibits wisdom and compassion, you have bumped into God. And of course, the story of Scripture is that God is incarnated into flesh and blood through Jesus, of course. And that's the idea, the ongoing idea of the Christian story, is that we encounter God in flesh and blood whenever we encounter wisdom and truth and compassion. And when we have friends, soul friends who exhibit that for us, if we have eyes to see, we will realize that in them, we bump into God. And of course, these friendships, they take time. They take trust to build. We don't just run into these by accident. They don't happen overnight. So I'm not saying you can go out and find a soul friend tomorrow. They take time and vulnerability and trust. But when we find these soul friends, our anam cara, speakers of wisdom, truth, and compassion, we have encountered God. So as we close this goat on a cow series, My hope is that this final teaching from Celtic spirituality allows us a new lens, allows us to realize that we bump into God more often than we realize. With Celtic spirituality, we bump into God in nature. There are gateways to heaven all around us if we would but have eyes to see. We bump into God when we encounter the good, good things of life, be it food, sex, laughter, wine, a hot shower, a massage, whatever it is, whatever comes to us as a good and perfect gift, James tells us, that's from God. We run into God when we encounter the goodness of life. And of course, we run into God through our friends, our deep friends, our soul friends who exhibit wisdom and compassion. So friends, may you come to see and know that God is not distant, far off, uninterested in life, but that God is walking among us, waiting to bump into us. And if we develop our eyes, strengthen our eyes, we'll come to see that God is all around us, bumping into us all the time through land, through the goodness of life, and through friends who exhibit wisdom and compassion. Thanks so much for joining us, Nexus. It looks like we'll be back strictly online next week, and so I'm hoping we'll have a bit of a new upgraded format for that. But I want to close this morning with St. Patrick's breastplate prayer. I think it will give you a taste of Celtic Christianity, and I think it's beautiful. It's a bit lengthy, but I want to close with his prayer. It goes this way. I bind unto myself today the strong name of the Trinity by invocation of the same, the three in one and one in three. I bind this day to me forever by power of faith, Christ's incarnation, his baptism in the Jordan River, his death on cross for my salvation, his bursting forth from spicy tomb, his riding up the heavenly way, his coming at the day of doom. I bind unto myself today. I bind unto myself the power of the great love of the cherubim, the sweet well done in judgment hour, the service of the seraphim, confessor's faith, apostle's word, the patriarch's prayer, the prophet's scrolls, all good deeds done to the Lord and purity of virgin souls. I bind unto myself today the virtues of the starlit heaven, the glorious sun's life-giving ray, the whiteness of the moon at even, the flashing of the lightning free, the whirling wind's tempestuous shocks, the stable earth, the deep salt sea around the old eternal rocks. I bind unto myself today the power of God to hold and lead, his eye to watch, his might to stay, his ear to hearken to my need, the wisdom of my God to teach, his hand to guide, his shield to ward, the word of God to give me speech, his heavenly host to be my guard. Against the demon snares of sin, the vice that gives temptation force, the natural lust that war within, the hostile men that mar my course, are few or many, far and nigh, in every place and in all hours. Against the fierce hostility, I bind to me these holy powers. Against all Satan's spells and wiles, against false words of heresy, against the knowledge that defiles, against the heart's idolatry, against the wizard's evil craft, against the death wound and the burning, the choking wave and the poison shaft, protect me, Christ, till thy returning. Christ be with me, Christ within me, Christ behind me, Christ before me, Christ beside me, Christ to win me, Christ to comfort and restore me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ in quiet, Christ in danger, Christ in hearts of all that love me, Christ in mouth of friend and stranger. I bind unto myself the name, the strong name of the Trinity, by invocation of the same, the three in one and one in three, of whom all nature hath creation. Eternal Father, Spirit, Word, praise to the Lord of my salvation. Salvation is of Christ the Lord. Friends, with that, amen, and go in peace.